a Rayo Original Podcast.
The biggest challenge we have is we're seeing too many constant threats. 1 in 8 are tired all the time. 1 in 4 is tired most of the time.
What do you think about coffee and caffeine?
Oh, 2 separate things.
Oh.
Most people aren't excessively stressed. They are inadequately recovered. But what we've got day in, day out is sort of death by 1,000 cuts. There'll be 1,000 messages an hour that says to my physiology, Ollie, be slightly ready. How do I convince my body that there is no threat?
It's kind of amazing.
It's amazing.
Because you can trick your brain into feeling safe just by changing your breath.
Those techniques have risen in popular culture because they are the antidote to the poison of the modern world. Your mind is your body and your body is your mind.
And I had this theory that taking sleeping pills doesn't allow you to get quality sleep, it just knocks you out. Is that true? Hello and welcome back to Rise with Roxy. If you've been feeling tired, wired, or just not quite yourself lately, then this episode is for you. Today's guest is someone I've wanted to sit down with for a long time. Ollie Patrick is one of the UK's leading physiologists and a pioneer in the field of lifestyle medicine. He's worked with everyone from elite athletes to high-performing executives. But what sets him apart is his deeply human, holistic approach to health. Ollie doesn't just talk about what we should be doing. He helps us understand why our bodies feel the way they do and how we can take back control in a world that often leaves us burnt out, stressed, and disconnected. In this conversation, we cover everything from sleep and stress to gut health, energy, and longevity. But most importantly, Ollie shares tools that are actually doable. No fear-mongering, no quick fixes, just real, practical wisdom grounded in science and compassion. Whether you're running on empty or just want to feel a bit more like yourself again, we've got you. Let's dive in. I am so excited to sit down with you. Thank you for being here. I have a million questions for you.
Oh my God, what's an absolute treat.
Well, I got told before you came, I mean, we've met before.
Yes.
But as well, my producer Molly, before we started, she said, Ollie knows everything about everything. So ask anything you want. And I was like, great, I'm going to.
I know a little bit about a lot of things, but not a lot about one thing.
Okay, so you are a physiologist.
Yes.
For those who don't know, what is it?
It's a weird job because it sort of, I did exercise physiology on the belief that I would go into elite sport. And elite physiology is sort of about optimizing sporting performance. So how can I improve the physiology of an individual so they can win more events? Mm-hmm. And physiology is how we work. You know, so as you and I sit here now, we are our physiology, our neurobiology, our cardiovascular system, our digestive system. So I really learned originally about how to harness, I suppose, physiology to improve sporting performance. Mm-hmm. And then dropped into the medical model where I took a job as a cardiac physiologist, trying to work out if someone was going to have a heart attack or not, which was extremely difficult, actually, because we were running sort of traditional medical tests to see if someone might get a heart attack. And the tests were really bad. For that test to show up that you've got cardiovascular disease, the arteries that supply blood to your heart need to be quite blocked up, maybe 80, 85% blocked.
Oh, right. So you need to be like right about there.
You need to be right about there. So you're looking someone in the eyes going, oh, I don't think you've got it. And then you find out, oh, they did have it. They had quite a lot of it.
Right.
And I found that was a really big challenge. So I ended up in cardiac physiology. And then interestingly, ended up getting more interested in the physiology of how we feel.
Yes.
So we're screening people. We're going, right, Roxy, are you well? And the doctor would check you for all the obvious cancers, all the obvious heart disease markers and say, you are well. Mm-hmm. And then I was at the last hour of a 3-hour medical dealing with people who had been told they were well, but were tired.
Yeah.
And told they were well, but they were brain foggy. Mm. Told they were well, but they were a little bit emotionally unavailable, or they had odd digestion, or they had knees that wouldn't let them do what they wanted to do at the weekends. And it was so interesting that we'd missed what individuals defined as well, based on the fact that the doctors had excluded obvious disease.
Yeah.
So I got really interested in how I could get some of that science from the sports science world into traditional medicine to talk, what is the physiology of stress? What is the physiology of nourishment, as in which of us is better nourished, not just who eats a better diet, but are we nourished from the food we eat? Mm. Which of us is sleeping better? Which of us has better clarity of thought? Mm-hmm. And over a period of time, basically started aggregating different technologies and built that into a health assessment model, and then wrote a qualification to turn sort of exercise physiologists into health and well-being physiologists when I was head of physiology at Nuffield Hospitals. But fundamentally, it was a case of who is a professional specializing in the measurement and improvement of the normal person? gen pop, as we might call it?
Well, I feel like everybody listening wants to know more about this because I think all of us want to feel better, right? And I think that there's this kind of epidemic of tiredness.
Yes.
It's weird because right now I'm feeling quite energized, but, and I've done a lot of work on myself to get to a point where I feel like I have some more natural energy. But if you asked me 6 months ago, I was just like, why am I tired every single day?
Yeah.
And I'd constantly ask people, are you tired every single day? Like,
yeah.
Is it just me? Or like, are we all tired?
We are.
And I think we are. Going,
yeah, we are. I think there was a YouGov poll that said 1 in 8 are tired all the time.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 4 is tired most of the time. So that's separate. So that's over a third of us who are tired most of the time.
I reckon it's more than that.
I reckon it's more than that.
Absolutely. And more actually, than 1 in 4 people I know are tired most of the time.
I would say, you know, it's closer to 1 in 4 isn't. And those people are really talking about it. They are bragging. They've got
100%. I agree. Okay. First question is, what are the biggest myths people have about physical well-being? The
biggest myth is that people think there's one thing that unlocks everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'll go onto a social media platform and someone will have taken vitamin D and they'll say, oh my God, vitamin D unlocked my energy. It was 3 out of 10, now it's 10 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would suggest that vitamin D is the salvation of humanity. And what you get is lots of people find what's their limiting factor. So they find something that was holding their physiology back, they unlock it and they proclaim it as a single point solution to everyone's woes and everyone's problems, which is very human. I think what we've got to recognize is there's no one thing that creates wellness or a state of well-being. It is the aggregate of behaviors over time offset against your genetics. So we all have our genes, and our genes are less impactful on our health and well-being than we originally thought. So we're not at the complete destiny of our genes, our DNA, but it definitely plays a role. But what we're at the mercy of is what are the inputs we're giving our physiology day in, day out, aggregated over time? And those aren't just exercise. So the exercise community will tell you can solve everything with a good workout and a good training split and periodization. The nutrition community will say, no, it's not about exercise. It's about nutrition and about nourishment and blood sugar control and about gut health. The sleep community will tell you it's all about sleep. The stress community will tell you it's all about stress.
Mm-hmm.
The psychology community will tell you it's about mindset. The physical environment community will tell you it's a toxic air, toxic water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's none of those things.
And the physiologists
will say it's all of them. It is a really challenging thing that I think people have been misled by because they're listening to these stories of people saving themselves through single point solutions. So there's nothing wrong with that message because I believe in it, but it has created a state of confusion.
And do you think that's why people find it so hard to make informed decisions and make better decisions because they're hoping it will be like one thing?
100%. And they'll find someone who looks a bit like me, sounds a bit like me, did something that I hope will work for me. So this is difficult because we never actually got an instruction manual to the most complicated machine in the world. And the most interesting part about a health assessment when you deliver one is the questionnaire people fill in at the beginning. So you're like, how have you ended up with this exercise routine, this nutritional strategy, this relationship with sleep, this relationship with yourself? And we're all sort of victim of these, you know, very strong polarized messages. And it's difficult for people to unpick what is their truth.
Mm.
And there's not a universal truth, there is their truth. So I have absolute empathy for how confusing it is. And there's a lot of people making a lot of money from creating further confusion because the wellness industry is booming.
You know,
it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world because people don't feel well, most people are tired and they are chasing things to make them feel better. And in many cases, they're chasing the wrong things, sadly.
Yeah. So if we were to take the kind of starting point for someone,
what
are the signs that someone isn't well or isn't as well as they could be?
So the answer of whether someone is well or not is the impossible question. You know, it may not be in a biological marker. You know, so for years I was involved in running the world's most advanced health assessment, and you know, we would take every biological marker we could take on a person, every blood test, every urine analysis, every saliva test, every stool test, every MRI, CT. We had this unbelievable product where we would measure everything for the hope of giving someone a really simple answer to their question, which is, am I well? And you might run all of those tests and the person looks good on paper across all of those tests, but they don't feel well.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, then we can't fully understand what drives our sense of well-being. And when we look at energy, which I think is probably the best barometer of well-being, that starting point of people feel tired, fatigue, not just physical fatigue, but low energy, I think is the best marker that you're doing something that's jarring with your physiology. So we've got to reconcile in the first instance, we may not be able to test why someone is not well. There are some traditional things we should exclude first, but our energy exists across at least four domains. My physical ability to manufacture energy, everything from my sleep to my nourishment to my cardiovascular fitness, for example. But I also exist on an emotional plane with connection and relationships and love and bonding. I exist on a mental plane. Am I growing? Am I learning? Am I contributing? And then on a spiritual plane, which is that sort of purpose and you know, do I matter? And what is my role here? And am I receiving affirmation for that role? Mm-hmm. When I'm wondering whether someone is well, we'd sort of start with focusing on where's their energy out of 100, for example, across those four planes. Mm-hmm. And is it changing? You know, and is it changing in the absence of an obvious lifestyle cause? And I think when we were doing advanced health assessments, what was really interesting is for all the intelligent screening we can do, the best screening test is still the person noticing that they've changed. Mm-hmm. My energy was 70, now it's 40, but I haven't changed job, I haven't changed relationship, I haven't changed exercise or diet. I used to pee 3 times a day and I pee 12 times a day, but I don't drink more. Or that mole used to be shaped like, you know, Europe, now it's shaped like Africa. So these things are really interesting. And actually observing change and noticing where your energy is depreciating is probably the best marker of wellness and well-being. Mm,
that's so interesting. So it really, because like we kind of said, people are feeling tired all the time. I think we talk about feeling tired all the time, but actually it is a really important indicator. Like feeling tired shouldn't be the norm. Is that what we're saying?
It shouldn't be the norm at all. And you shouldn't feel more tired year on year. And hormones and life cycles play a role, but we should have consistent energy through our lifespan. We really should. And I've met a lot of people who had the best energy of their lives in their later years because they unlocked the thing that was blocking their energy. Mm. And in some of those cases, that was emotional. Some of those cases, it was very physical. But I think using energy as our best barometer, you know, as in, do I feel I've got the energy to get up and lead the life I expect to lead without caffeine, without stimulants, without addictive behaviors? Have I got the relationships that embed in my life? Have I got the growth and development? Have I got a sense of purpose? That's where we sort of really would see the best opportunity to focus on well-being. But reconciling energy is the best sort of single point barometer, I think, of well-being is a sensible place to start.
Mm. Oh, I love that. Okay, so we are going to work on that energy today. What is something that you've seen in the body that reflects a person's emotional or mental state?
The gut-brain axis is so established that when we see a dysregulated gut, and that can mean multiple different things. When often people talk about the gut, they're not always clear. Are they talking about, but let's think for purposes of the gut, we're looking at digestive markers. Mm-hmm. When we would often find dysregulated gut, we would find dysregulated emotion. Mm. Now, that's not to say causality, that the dodgy gut meant the person didn't have, you know, quality emotional stability or had difficulties managing temper flares or difficulty, you know, showing empathy. But there's a very clear correlation between those things. I think, you know, what we saw clinically is when there's a dysregulated gut, it's sensible to improve the function of the gut before you isolate talking about talking therapies or psychological therapies in isolation, because those two things are so interlinked. And I would add to that as well, sleep. You know, in terms of if someone is not recovering well, recovery is a bigger topic than sleep, but sleep is our biggest opportunity to recover. You know, if you have low physical energy restoration, then some behaviors will manifest as a direct result of that. You know, you will be more argumentative because it's adrenalizing. It will lift the energy you didn't fill up over the night.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you will find energy. So if you don't sleep well last night, you'll still find energy today, but you'll find it through false means potentially. Some of those false means might be behavioral, mm-hmm. as in you can find false energy through caffeine.
Yeah.
You can find false energy through refined carbohydrate foods that will, mm-hmm. again, elicit a sort of, you know, a neurotransmitter cascade that says, well done, you know, you found short-term energy. You can find it through being grumpy, which mm-hmm. might in many cases trigger you to manufacture more energy as a result of that. So we see mood, nutritional, broad behavior impacts. We also see a lethargy that may not transfer into physical exercise, which is a great way of regulating mood. And this sort of, I suppose the closer you look at it, Roxy, you go, there is no mind, there's just body. You know, so much of the way we think is affected by the balance of neurotransmitters, by blood flow to the brain, by the clearing of toxins or not. And when we think about how do I improve my mind, the first thing we'd want to do is say, make sure my body's giving my mind the best opportunity to think clearly. And in the same way, say, don't make big decisions fatigued.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're debating a divorce or a change of job and you haven't got the physical energy to make the right decision, fix the physical energy before potentially looking upstream. And it's a two-way house, because you can start in the brain and work down to the body as well. You know, a person that doesn't think they're worthy of the behaviors to go to bed early, or the person doesn't feel they're worthy of clearing the time in the diary to exercise or food prepping. So it's not a case of you have to do one or the other, you should do both.
Yeah.
The order you do them in would be probably at the discretion of where you feel the most likely first stone could be laid. But your mind is your body and your body is your mind. But the gut, sleep, you know, are two things where you'd say sort those out imminently if you want to improve state of mind.
I think it's so important that, because I think we so often do separate them completely. And we talk about mood and happiness or depression and anxiety and stress. And we really talk about it in a way that is just so mental and so about our thought processes and about the things that we're saying to ourselves and our relationships and our boundaries. And we forget that actually so much of it is impacted by what we're putting in our body and how we're moving it. And I think that for me, I had suffered from depression probably from about 12 years old until a few years ago, I would say. And I remember that when I would go on these like health retreats, right? I'd go because I was just obsessed with wanting to lose weight, right? I was in that diet culture.
Yeah.
But what I'd always notice is at the end of this week, I would suddenly feel this like glimmer of happiness.
Yes.
And I was like, oh,
yeah,
there's something in this, because I don't feel as low when my body is nourished and when I'm exercising. And so I remember finding that out quite early and not knowing if there was actually anything in it. But it's clear that it is true. You can change how you feel by changing how you fuel and feed yourself.
Enormously. It's really important, because There are clinical depressions that are not driven by lifestyle at all.
Mm-hmm.
But not being driven by lifestyle doesn't mean lifestyle won't improve the symptoms of those things.
Yeah.
So at every state of, you know, of poor mental health or mental ill health, we should be using lifestyle to depreciate the symptoms of that or make it more manageable, working alongside clinical professionals, working alongside, again, traditional therapies. But there's no situation, no physiological state where being more rested, being more nourished, moving more, connecting with humans, connecting with nature, learning, growing, wouldn't improve how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
What I used to find so interesting was that the behaviors we'd give to someone in rehabilitation, so when you've had a significant health concern, let's call it a heart attack, and we're rehabilitating you, and the behaviors we'd give to an elite athlete, and the behaviors we give in well-being, they're all the same thing. They're all, how do I make your physiology work better? And the inputs are the same at all stages, rehab, well-being, performance. They're all about, how do I get better quality movement, better quality nourishment, better quality rest and recovery, including sleep, better quality thoughts, and better quality physical environment. And the dosage requires a bit of variance, and tone of voice requires variance, but physiology takes the same inputs no matter where you find it.
If we focus on those things, we can hope to at least improve our symptoms somewhat, but hopefully improve them greatly.
Enormous. And you know, we will know people who completely reverse the conditions through that. There'll be others with stubborn genes where it will depreciate their symptoms and work as part of a collective approach. But for those people who are drifting towards a state they don't want to be in, well, we've got to be careful to say lifestyle may not be the cause, but lifestyle can certainly prove part of the solution.
Yeah. So now let's take it the other way around. So how can having a healthy mindset improve how you feel?
I like the work of a psychologist, Dr. Vanessa Moulton, who I work with as a model of psychological fitness. And it's really saying, look, I view human physiology on a continuum from it doesn't work at all and I'm dead, to it works extremely well and I can do incredible things, you know, climb mountains and complete marathons. And physiology is linear. Yeah, so it works linear. But so is our psychological well-being. Between plus 100, which might be called flourishing or, you know, self-actualization, and then minus 100, which would be significant, you know, clinical disorders of the mind, psychosis or you know, conditions that would normally need treating in institutes. So we've all got this spectrum. The question is, how do I improve the way I think? You know, and there are lots of different models in there, some of which, you've brought to the masses, I think, actually, Roxy, in terms of, you know, real value in being able to provide self-care, affirmations, you know, visualization. This all plays an absolutely critical role. what I like about the model of psychological fitness is what are the 10 things that I can do that would improve my ability to improve my psychological well-being? And I'll pick out a couple. So one is self-compassion, which sits at the heart of all good feeling. You know, I must be kind to myself. And that must be that internal narrative, not just the sort of external behaviors, but do I look in the mirror and genuinely say nice things about myself? But compassion for others would be another thing. So I know lots of my clients, when I worked in the sort of ultra high net worth community, found great well-being benefit by suddenly moving out of constant introspection to, do you know what? I'm going to do something for others. Philanthropy.
It's step 7 of my 8 steps to knowing your worth in my confidence book is be of service to others.
Oh, man. Yeah, you get to that point where you realize you can optimize yourself too much to a degree. And suddenly, you know, where we see people in caregiving roles or volunteer roles or just doing something selfless, you know, if you help someone across the road, you are buzzing off.
It feels good to do good.
It feels good to do good. Mm. And so lean into that deliberately. Mm-hmm. Developing grit as a muscle, my ability to persevere to long-term projects. Mm-hmm. That's an unbelievable trait that can be trained by getting behaviors that you stick with and building support networks you carry on. If I can develop some practical habits around these key areas, then I can expect the quality of my thoughts to improve, and I can expect the downstream impact on my physiology to improve as well.
What is that downstream impact?
The biggest challenge we have that I would see in my, and again, I have my own biases, but the biggest challenge is, which ties into fatigue, is we're seeing too many constant threats. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is hyper-stimulating. And what we're seeing from a neurological point of view is an increased propensity to be in a state of hypervigilance. So if I'm not kind to myself, if I'm not kind to others, if I don't have grit and resilience, what I will encounter is tons and tons and tons of inputs. And we're learning more and more about this volume of inputs. And we're saying, look, the day you and I are waking up into today is so odd to our physiology, from the constant light, the constant noise, the constant connectivity, the constant comparison, the food being, you know, in a way that I've never designed to eat, and every device saving me labor at every turn so I don't move at all, whereas years ago this wasn't possible. What we often see is the brain is in this sort of perpetual state of scanning, and it's staying in a low level state of preparation. And what that ultimately means is we spend all our time expending our battery rather than recharging it. And years ago, when I started to get into the physiology of how would I measure stress, and who is going to burn out and who is not going to burn out, and is stress really good for us? And the answer is stress is really good for us. But when stress exceeds our ability to cope for too long, we run out of gas. And what was interesting about the deeper I went down that rabbit hole is we find most people aren't excessively stressed. They are inadequately recovered. Mm. When we think of the big stressors, you know, bereavements or moving house or change of job, they happen, but they happen infrequently. But what we've got day in, day out is sort of death by 1,000 cuts. There'll be 1,000 messages an hour that says to my physiology, Ollie, be slightly ready. Ollie, be slightly on guard. And that means I'm not getting 1,000 messages an hour going, Ollie, you're off duty, restore energy, recoup. And when we looked at this through physiology, we can measure something called heart rate variability, which gives us insight to look at whether my body is slightly ready for threat or slightly ready for calm. We found pretty historically in high-performing individuals that they were consistently ready for a low level of threat. And that meant they exhaust themselves over time. And I think, you know, when we look at brain into body, how do I convince my body that there is no threat, that the noises can be drowned out, that I can be still, that I can be in a place of true safety? Those techniques have risen in popular culture because they are the antidote to the poison of the modern world. And one of those would be mindfulness, which is an incredibly valuable tool. So meditation, mindfulness, these were things that I think sit really closely between, are they mind, are they body? They are body and mind. Mm. But I probably saw in that advanced sort of clinical practice, meditation be the second most powerful thing after moving people from sedentary to active in transforming whole states of health.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I have seen that myself so much. And I'm constantly saying to people, like even recently, for example, I started doing sound baths.
Yeah.
It's the only class that I will go into where they will say to you, you need to do nothing. Just lie down and take in the music, the sound, the noise. And so for me, what I found is committing time to being still, doing nothing, having a little sleep, whatever it is, has meant that my ability to handle stress day to day is so much greater. And what I kept saying was that my life is no less busy, but I feel less stressed even in amongst the busyness because I've got these moments of recovery, of stillness, of restoration. And now a scientist has told me that I'm right.
You're 100% right. And I would say, you know, this is a pocketed block of recovery. And that recovery is, yeah, it's physiological. It's certainly, you know, in many cases, psychological, you know, that stillness, that sort of single point of focus or absence of focus. It's spiritual in many cases. And in fact, we're totally realigning with who we want to be in those moments. And these things can all work on multiple different levels. I've seen, again, lots of people through traditional advanced medical protocols not find results that they did find fairly quickly by exploring, again, what might be deemed alternative methodologies, be that sound healing, be that, again, body talk, be that Reiki, be it reflexology, things that pull on biological systems that we can't fully quantify. And so, you know, the practice should form part of a holistic integrated approach, but not as an alternative to it would be my opinion.
Let's say you had a patient who is feeling unwell, right? Their energy is down and they have this constant threat, as you kind of described, this constant like stress.
Yes.
And you wanted them to kind of tap into that parasympathetic or activate that parasympathetic nervous system more often.
Yep.
What would be the kind of optimum time per day or week that people should try to do that?
So I got asked a really good question the other day, which is if I'm on it all day long, you know, if I'm in this sympathetic, alert, hypervigilant state all my waking hours, but I fall asleep on the nose and I get my, you know, 7 to 9 hours of sleep, let's call it 8, but 7 to 9 is what we should be aiming for. Can I get away with it? And the answer is we don't know, probably. But I don't know anyone who can fall into a deep restorative quality sleep architecture, having been completely on it for the 16, 17 hours they're awake. Because in what scenario would you be ready for a massive threat all day long and then close your eyes and pretend the world is at peace? So it's sort of a mythological state. I think, you know, when I've seen in clinical practice, and these are pockets of, you know, hundreds of people, not tens of thousands, what we generally see is sleep is our greatest opportunity to restore energy. And if it's not good quality, at some point we're going to get caught out. Mm-hmm. But pockets of recovery in the day have a huge impact on whether that sleep will be good. Years ago, I did a program with a civil service, and we were looking at the physiology of stress, and we're sort of tracking sleep, tracking heart rate variability, and we found slightly better results. And this was before the smartphone era, slightly better results for stress management and sleep in smokers. And I was like, what? Yeah. And I'm not promoting smoking, let's be clear. And we sort of, well, what's going on? And the smokers were taking a 5-minute break every hour. And they were congregating outside and they were socially connecting and, you know, sharing a ciggy, you know, who's got a lighter. And they were defragging throughout the course of the day. That meant they were actually having these like mini restorative breaks that meant as they could enter sleep, they enter sleep faster and they went into better stages of sleep. Mm-hmm. And that was offset against the fact nicotine is a sleep disruptor and a stimulant. Yeah. Now, that's not a published study. That was anecdotal, working on one case. But it's interesting in the fact that when we're really looking to restore energy, it shouldn't be feast and famine. Mm-hmm. It needs to be these micro doses through the course of the day that give our body the sense it's not continually at war or continually at rest. Mm. It's sort of mixing between those two states.
Absolutely. I mean, I often say to people, because I love meditation, okay? And, you know, it's a big part of my own practice and well-being practice. And I said, even if you just set a timer for 2 minutes and just breathe for 2 minutes, that is something. And if you could do that, you know, 3 times a day, that could be beneficial.
Enormous. Every step you take that you didn't take before is a positive, because physiology is linear. Every minute you spend in quality breath is a minute you're not anticipating threat. But I think, you know, beyond full meditation, breath work is that instant recalibrator. You know, breath is slightly separate to meditation in the sense that I can immediately alter my state through my breath, whether I'm believing it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, so because that nervous system evolved in stress and recovery, so sympathetic, think of our stress nervous system, parasympathetic, our recovery system, they're both attached to my respiratory system, my breathing. So on a very simple basis, if I can breathe out longer than I breathe in, I will induce calm physically. whether I believe it or not, I will induce calm.
It's kind of amazing.
It's amazing.
Because you can trick your brain into feeling safe just by changing your breath.
100%. And this is one big feedback loop. If my breath tells my brain it's safe, it will stop looking for the thing to worry about. But if my brain spots something to worry about, my breath rate increases, which tells my brain there really must be something to worry about, Ollie. So I start scanning for the next thing. So breath is the break. It's the break circuit, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a circuit breaker. And the science of that is so robust, whether it's extended exhalation, whether it's breath holds, whether it's nasal breathing, which is preferable to mouth breathing. But if we combine breath work and meditation, we've got this absolute double whammy that says, okay, really, that's a shield against the modern world. Everything's telling you, be alert, be ready, get ready for what's next. Breathe through your mouth, breathe fast. If we're still and slow, focused on one thing, breathing through our nose, it is an incredibly powerful way of quickly restoring energy that plays into sleep, plays into everything.
Love that. Okay, seeing as we started talking about sleep, I want to go into sleep. Now, Ollie, I've just got myself an Oura ring.
Oh.
Me and my sister both have an Oura ring. And so we are on circles so we can see each other's score.
Yep.
Now, she had always complained about being a terrible sleeper.
Yeah.
I had always been like, I am so good at sleeping. I have not beaten her on one day. What I've learned with the Oura ring is it measures your REM,
yes,
which is when you're dreaming,
yep,
deep sleep,
yep,
and then light sleep.
Yes.
What I have found is that apparently I some nights have 13 minutes of deep sleep.
Okay.
So could you please explain to me what is the difference between REM, light, and deep?
Yeah.
What do they each do? And how can I get those numbers up? Because I need to be my sister.
Well, you being your sister is a great incentive. I think that this is the new world of, mm-hmm, you know, wearables are collecting data without as much context as we would like. And mm-hmm, they're all getting better at this, mm-hmm, by the way. I think that the first and most important thing with tracking sleep is to determine when you wake up within that 30 minutes of waking, do you feel that you've restored your energy,
mm-hmm,
you know? And if you do, if you fall asleep well, you stay asleep and you wake up with relatively refreshed energy, then normally I don't encourage people to track their sleep because what are we looking for? Yeah, what are we looking for? And the danger is creating a problem where there wasn't one. The great nightmare we've got with the wearable revolution is people waking up going, how did I sleep? And they ask a device,
yes,
rather than asking themselves.
It's true.
Right? So the first thing I want you to do is ask yourself. So I love the hyper-personalization of sleep, but I don't want people starting with the number, start with the feeling. And the first thing we've got to do before we start worrying about REM and deep is give sleep the opportunity to go through these different stages, what we call sleep architecture. The architecture is that different states of sleep take place during the night, generally in these cycles of 90 to 120 minutes. And there's two types of sleep, rapid eye movement sleep called REM sleep, where we have our dream state and lots of our cognitive firing. And then non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is phased on how slow your brainwaves go. So non-REM stage 1 and 2 would be light sleep. Non-REM 3 and 4 is deep sleep. They all do different things. So we could drive people mad. But generally, let's think of deep sleep is where the real energy restoration comes, the real growth and repair.
Mm-hmm.
And what deep sleep is reflecting is it's called slow wave sleep because your brainwaves go to its slowest rate of activity. You literally go into, you know, your lowest breathing rate, and your body fixes itself. But deep sleep is the rock star. People who are wearing wearables will see most of their deep sleep comes in the first two sleep cycles, so the first three and a half hours of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Then REM sleep, which we get traditionally more of towards the waking hours, again, more of our dream state. We have this real ability of replaying life events without the attached emotion. And that's an important part of getting over the traumas of daily living. So REM sleep and trauma are both closely associated in function and dysfunction. Deep's maybe more interesting because, you know, the big challenge with deep sleep is for you to go into that state where your brainwaves are so slow, where you're breathing so, you know, so low and so light, and your body to be that detached from the world, you must believe there's nothing you would need to wake up for.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to bed waiting for something, believing you need to be available, it will come at the cost of deep sleep. And the challenge is, you know, you can have two people who get 7 hours, one of them listening for a child in a strange hotel room with an early flight to catch, the other one getting 7 hours in a comfortable environment, dark, cool, and calm, and they will wake up with markedly different levels of energy restored. And the modern world is challenging your ability to believe you're safe. You know, we have a phrase that's been coined called an anxiogenic environment, so anxiety generating. We had the World Health Organization called our environment obesogenic years ago because everything that gets invented saves me calories. I don't have to move anywhere. And then 70% of my food in the UK is ultra processed. So energy dense food plus no movement means I gain weight. Now we have anxiogenic, which means everything today is telling you to be worried about something a little bit. And unless you go to bed with a clean mental inbox, believing you're in that moment you're in, believing that you won't have to wake up, you couldn't possibly let yourself get into proper deep sleep. But we've got also the rise of cooling. So for you to go into quality deep sleep, you need to your body temperature to drop by 1 degree. Mm-hmm. You need ideally to be in as much dark light as possible. So we need no light hitting the back of your eyeball to really manufacture melatonin, which helps move you into that state of sleep.
For example, I've got a Kindle recently.
Yeah.
Because I am actually very good in the evenings. I really prioritize winding down. Yeah. I'm in bed by 8. I'm asleep by 9:30.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll get a Kindle and start reading.
Yes.
I find that reading makes my eyes really tired and I fall asleep straight away.
Love it.
But what I have found is that on the days that I'm reading, my sleep score is worse.
Interesting.
And I wonder if it's because it's like the story is, it's like energizing me in some way. Is that possible?
Totally possible. So the great question, there was a study that showed that the blue light from devices does suppress melatonin. So melatonin is, again, this really important hormone that we produce that helps us move into quality sleep and has a range of vital processes. And it doesn't like light of any description. So we saw some reduced melatonin production when people were on devices. But what's more concerning, because that was relatively de minimis, is what you are encountering. So, you know, if I'm reading a serial killer book, then, you know, I'm going to go to bed slightly thinking there might be a serial killer kicking about or what's going to happen next. So we find a difference, you know, in again, clinical practice between familiar sort of romantic novels versus a page turner, because that wouldn't tell your brain that I'm completely free from anything I need to solve between now and waking hours.
Right.
So, you know, and that's where devices become really useful, because there are no rules that are universal. Someone will watch, you know, a horror film on Netflix and fall into quality deep sleep. So what you can't do is go out and say, that's a rule. Mm. What you can say is, if I'm watching my response to my behaviors, I can calibrate. And so that's where the device is really serving you to go, something about that is worth reviewing. Not that it's good or bad, but it's worth reviewing.
I do feel like I'm constantly having proof of how important sleep, not just sleep hours, as you say, because I would have always thought I had good sleep hours.
Yeah.
But sleep quality is so important. And I don't think I would have known that if it wasn't for me wearing this.
I think that is the perfect example. You know, it will build those associations. For most people, it will change their relationship with alcohol, because they'll realize alcohol fragments all stages of sleep.
So many people have said that after having a wearable, they won't even have one drink. What are the effects of just one drink?
It will depend. I've met French and Italians who do all right on the one drink, truth be told. And I don't know whether there are genes that detoxify alcohol and caffeine quicker or slower. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for most people, there'll be a dosage which is much lower than they would anticipate, be that 1 unit, 2 units, 3 units. So, you know, a small glass of wine, half a beer, where alcohol works as a bit of a muscle relaxant. Mm-hmm. So it reduces that tension that comes with being alert all day. So it feels like a stress reliever. It can drop the activation of my prefrontal cortex, which holds back true Ollie from the world, that slightly, you know, riskier version of me that I think, don't say that in public and don't do that. So it sort of releases me a bit more as a character, drops my muscles, so it feels like a stress reliever. But really, it does create the opposite effect, in the fact that it in many ways compounds stress, largely through the fact it just cannibalizes REM sleep in particular, but also deep sleep. So you will fall asleep faster. So it improves sleep latency. Mm. So this is where people have to distinguish. Being asleep is not the same as quality of sleep. Mm. So it sedates you, but sleep in many ways is an active biological process. Mm. It requires this deliberate sort of movement through all these different patterns of brainwaves, and alcohol kills that.
I've often said with sleeping pills, because I have a lot of friends that take sleeping pills, whether that be over the counter or Xanax.
Yeah.
And for me, I mean, I took a lot of drugs in my life, and Xanax for me was the worst in terms of how awful it made me and how depressed it made me afterwards. But what I found was that anytime I took any type of sleeping pill, I felt so much more tired the next day.
Yes.
And I had this theory that taking sleeping pills doesn't allow you to get quality sleep, it just knocks you out. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah. So they don't drive sleep architecture. And some people need to take the pill to build the energy to build the behavior. Mm-hmm. So that there is, you know, a judicious use of these things. And I would always say again, if someone has got an inability to fall asleep or stay asleep that's lasted, you know, over 6 weeks, mm-hmm. then let's investigate that through your GP in the first instance, mm-hmm. your traditional doctor, because there may be a obvious clinical cause of that.
Yeah.
If you are so exhausted that you can't conceive going for the walk at lunchtime, which we know will improve sleep, you can't mm-hmm. conceive controlling caffeine intake, controlling alcohol intake, that you're totally stuck, then using those drugs, again, under the care of a traditional physician, mm-hmm. is a very logical step, but they don't drive sleep architecture. They sedate you on the basis that you will restore more energy than you would have done without them.
Yeah.
But they give you the opportunity to build in the behaviors that get you back into quality sleep.
Just to finish off on sleep, what are just some simple changes people could make to improve their quality of sleep?
So the great sleep data, now we've got devices like Oura and Whoop and Garmin. These are all collecting data in a way we've never seen before. We've seen sleep consistency rise to almost equal importance as sleep volume, i.e. do I roughly wake up at the same time and roughly go to bed at the same time across all 7 days? And what you'll find is, to beat your sister, go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time.
Yeah.
Because that contributes quite a lot to your percentage scores, mm-hmm. even outside of the architecture piece. Mm-hmm. Because our body is running on this hormone, cortisol, that gets released a few hours before we wake up, and melatonin that gets released a few hours before we go to sleep, those hormones can really only optimize if there's a consistent waking and sleeping time. Mm-hmm. And of those two, it seems waking is the more important.
Yeah.
And that would be across, again, weekends as well. And we find people with what we call social jet lag, where they massively sleep in at the weekend, yeah. massively go out. So you can go out a bit later at the weekend. If you're lying in, the data seems to suggest up to an hour sleeping later still works well at the weekend. Mm-hmm. But then restoring energy with naps and other forms of non-sleep deep rest is a better way than just sort of, you know, feast and famine again with sleep. So from a sleep point of view, you know, before someone checks out whether they've got a disorder, I'd say, do you roughly wake up and go to bed at the same time? Do you get 30 minutes of natural sunlight in the first hour of waking, which is an important, again, reset of our biological clock? So our body absolutely responds to light. So 10 minutes of bright sunshine, 20, 30 minutes of overcast in that first hour. Did I stop all caffeinated drinks at lunchtime? Did I avoid alcohol in the evening? Did I get 10,000 steps, some of which were outside? And did I go to bed at the same time each night? And if I do those things, in most cases, most people will find an improvement, not necessarily a magic pill, but an improvement. So from a behavior point of view, mm-hmm. we want to fix up those things. Then, and an area we'll cross over on is the power of things like journaling. So journaling is really interesting technique in terms of how do I get out all those things that are swirling around mm-hmm. in my brain onto paper where I don't feel I've got to hold them in my brain. We see a to-do list in the evening is a brilliant thing because then I don't have to keep in my mind the things I'm going to do the following day. We always encourage people to have a notepad by their bed. So if a thought comes to them, write it down. Don't keep it in your brain because, again, then you're inhibiting that deep sleep where you might lose it. If you can cool down your bedroom, keep it cool. But, you know, cool, calm, quiet bedrooms with those other behaviors. But sleep relies on behaviors that start from the moment you wake up throughout the course of the day. And if you get those behaviors right, sleep will improve. Whether it improves enough is always that interesting question.
Mm. I love hearing that journaling really is a kind of like scientifically proven, powerful way to improve the quality of your sleep and your overall well-being. Let's take somebody that's had a day that is highly stressful and not necessarily stressful in the way that we think, but physically stressful.
Yep.
So maybe it's that they've, gone on stage and they release loads of adrenaline for that performance, or they've played in a netball match or yep. whatever it is. How important is it that they kind of come down from that in a mindful way so that they can sleep well? And what do those kind of like that journaling and talking, are those also applicable to helping people after a day like that?
Enormously. And they wouldn't, you wouldn't be in a state to do them until you've decompressed physically. Recovery in sports performance is my ability, you know, to return my physiology to baseline. So how quickly can I go on stage again, play again, et cetera. And there we'd have techniques that would start with things like compression. So we'd use compression trousers or leggings to keep circulating blood and lymph and remove some of the toxins, you know, some of the byproducts of exercise. We've seen the rise of cold. So cold is a very important way of changing my state. So cold and heat correlate also quite neatly with those those states of the nervous system. So when my body is physiologically ready for stress, it's a little warmer. When it's physiologically ready for calm, it's a little cooler. Mm. So using cold to change my state is also a really important
thing. A cold shower at the end of a very active day could help.
Could help. And cold showers are challenging because they're quite stimulating. And what we find the data on cold showers is right. In the morning, they seem to help with work-related absence from you know, so work-related immune dysfunction. So mm-hmm. days off sick, fundamentally, if you can bear them. Mm-hmm. But because they're sort of a constant battle to stay in, they seem less effective than cold water immersion. So right. The rise of cold plunges, et cetera. And they're a mixed bag because for some people, they are adrenalizing and activating.
But I see.
The first minute and a half of cold immersion is definitely stimulating. Minutes after that will generally put people into a state of induced calm. And again, we'll see the rise also of technologies that will try and cool the bedroom or the bed deliberately. So there's mattresses now that are the opposite of a heated blanket. You put them on and they cool your body to 1 degree less than...
Really?
Yeah. So they're one of the fastest growing well-being technologies in the States.
Oh, I'm due a new mattress soon.
Well, these are
so
genius.
There we go.
They're very clever. So they're not, they are a mattress topper. And they basically measure your sleep.
Yeah.
And then in measurement of your sleep, they identify when you're in deep sleep, when you're in REM sleep. Now, we know deep sleep is more associated with cooler temperatures, mm-hmm. REM slightly warmer temperatures. So it would spot you moving out of deep sleep, drop the temperature automatically, and bring you back in.
God, I love
so
technology.
It's clever. Now, the average person doesn't need all that because we're designed to have days where we get it wrong. Mm. Physiology is extremely elastic. You know, we can get this wrong. You know, there are blocks of time, months, years, where we have to accept that we won't restore as much energy as would be ideal. And we'll find ways to manipulate energy in other ways. Mm-hmm. So what we mustn't do is make people obsessive about balancing the books daily because your physiology doesn't work like that. And I think we've just got to view, again, our behaviors holistically and say, if there's one domain, let's call it sleep, where I'm challenged, mm-hmm. then I probably need to work a little bit harder on my nutrition or my movement to compensate for that.
Right.
And we only find real problems when people sort of let one cascade into the other. So I don't sleep well, so I don't eat well, so I don't move well, and that all or nothing approach. But I think there'll be science that proves one night of bad sleep does have an impact on a few variables, but there'll be an awful lot of lived practitioner experience that says we can withstand the storm much more effectively than people think.
We'll move on quickly to nutrition. I don't want to go loads into nutrition, but I just have a few questions.
Yeah, bro.
One is, what do you think about coffee and caffeine?
Oh, two separate things.
Oh.
Yeah, so coffee is great for you. You know, it's a rich source of antioxidants and flavonoids. And mm-hmm. and again, seemingly, you know, there'll be a study on a regular basis showing that the potent phytonutrients in coffee is really beneficial mm-hmm. for health. Caffeine, we've got to take as two things. It is an ergogenic aid. So if we are doing an athletic event, it will help us with that. It's quite effective at improving my fat metabolism and in certain areas. But it has a clear impact on reducing, again, sleep quality and sleep onset. And it's a great challenge if I take it in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And there'll be great debates on how long caffeine lasts in our bloodstream. But let's imagine a half-life of 5 to 7 hours. So it's still kicking about in my body 14 hours after I took it. It's a pretty impressive physiology that takes a coffee at 4 or 5 p.m. and it isn't sitting in your brain disrupting sleep, you know, come 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I often talk about, you know, if I travel into a mainline London train station and see every single person on an early morning train drinking what I assume is a caffeinated drink. They might be a chamomile tea, but I'm gambling, Roxy. It's not a chamomile tea. It's a caffeinated drink. You would say, are we taking a medication to cover up the symptom of something? Fatigue is a feedback loop telling you've done something. So you've inadequately slept, or you've inadequately connected, or you've inadequately moved, or you've inadequately nourished. Mm-hmm. And then what I'll do is I'll take that signal and I'll bury it, because there's 15 different versions of a Colombian, you know, bean that I'm interested in. Mm. And my worry with coffee is not what's in it, it's what it hides, which is a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And if I bury that feedback loop, then I can't complain too much when something else pops up down the line. And so, you know, coffee, good for you. Caffeine in moderation, strategically used outside of sleep. And it's also mimics, it's what we call a central nervous system stimulant. So it will exacerbate that feeling of stress, some, you know, more for others than some. But the biggest challenge is if I'm losing that feedback loop of how tired I am, how can I know whether I'm getting this lifestyle right or wrong?
Yeah, I love that. I think that's such a great answer. What about pre and probiotics, and what's the difference between pre and pro?
Good question. So probiotics would refer to the live bacteria that populates our gut microbiome. So the great horror of humans is that we are probably more bacteria than we are human cells. So we've got these trillions of bacteria that live in our mucous membranes, in our skin, but mostly in our gut, in our large intestine. And those bacteria are lots of different families that do different jobs. And effectively, they live there feeding on what I eat. So if I eat a fibrous food, it will go all the way through to my large intestine. One of those living bacteria will consume that fiber, and it will then manufacture elements that support my brain health, my immunity, and much of my immune system. So my ability to resist a cold and a flu and cancer cells is born from the relationship between fiber in my diet and these bacteria living in my large intestine. So lots of people don't have great bacteria in the first place. Then we use antibiotics to solve problems like viruses, which are not requiring of an antibiotic. And we potentially, you know, don't eat diets that are rich in fiber. So if I have low bacterial exposure, regular antibiotic use, and a low fiber diet, I won't have that many bacteria in my gut doing that job that, around the immunity and all the other things. So a probiotic will be living bacteria that I hope and believe will make it through to my large intestine and colonize, get there, stay there, breed, move in with the family, bring your kids, bring your cousins. That's what I need. So a probiotic could be capsule, could be liquid, could be, we often call probiotic foods our fermented foods, which I think you've spoken about on the pod before. So kimchi, kombucha, kefir, sauerkraut. If these foods are raw, they will have living bacteria in them. So they act as a probiotic food versus a probiotic supplement. That's a probiotic. Prebiotic are the fibers that will feed those families. So right. Prebiotic would be the fibers that we would ideally get through diverse vegetable sources, through nuts, through whole grains, that would make it all the way through a lovely working digestive system. But they are effectively the fuel to keep those bacteria alive. So if you put prebiotics in, but you've got no probiotics, you're feeding no one. Right. If you put probiotics in, but without prebiotics, they'll die. So it's right. it's a
harmony.
Can you
get prebiotics as capsules as well?
You can. Yeah,
but
generally.
Is it better as?
Always better as food, because the different, this is where the sort of the work of Zoe and you know, those who've been tracking gut microbiomes for a while, we got to this idea that can I get 20 to 30 different plant-based foods a week? With that idea being those different plant-based fibers found in different colors and different types of food feed different bacteria that do different jobs. So diversity and plant-based is the crux of good gut health, you know, and then hoping that I've got the right bacteria there in the first place.
Amazing. I think as well, I think when it comes to nutrition, you've just said it, it's diversity, trying to eat different things, something I'm terrible at.
It's tough. Well, it's tough because
it's hard.
Everything you have the chance to eat has been afflicted. You know, we're driven by flavor, not by nourishment. And we've got this challenge, you know, at the moment, we're about 70% of UK's calories coming from ultra processed food. So food that by very nature has had, you know, I couldn't make it in my kitchen. It's probably got five or more ingredients. That's a snapshot definition. But the biggest nutrient stripped out from ultra processed food is fiber, you know, and so fiber is such an interesting thing because it's been stripped out of our food system to make our food quicker to eat, more immediately neurotransmitter, and most notably dopamine releasing. And, you know, and flavorful, although a false flavor. And at the same time, we've seen the development of this drug GLP-1 agonists, which makes me feel full, slows food moving through my digestive system, and improves my sensitivity to insulin, which is what fiber does. So I find it really interesting watching the GLP-1, you know, craze, which I'm all behind GLP-1, by the way. It's a glucagon-like peptide, something my body naturally produces. So Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, this is a really clever, brilliant medication. But we must recognize that three of its key mechanisms of action are substituting what I would have got from a high fiber diet in the first place.
Interesting.
While we strip fiber out over here, we inject it over here.
So why are you behind it?
Because obesity is a real challenge. And I think there's a lack of empathy to obesity that, you know, it certainly has some, you know, genetic factors involved, has a huge socioeconomic factor involved. And if you've worked with people who are, you know, clinically overweight, they will have great challenges and unequivocally that increase in let's assume that weight is predominantly body fatness and that fat is intra-abdominal or visceral, that's an increased risk of heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, you know, almost every key disease. And they've got dealt a tough hand. Now, I always say to people who are challenged by obesity, it may not always be their fault, but it is their problem. And so giving people a tool to get themselves out of that situation is critical. And I think some of the big challenges are misunderstanding of the drug, you know, and nervousness about it. There are unknown unknowns, and we have to factor that in. But, you know, a GLP-1 taken with quality weight training and good nourishment guidance, I think it could be a salvation of the national health system. And the sooner we recognize that, the better.
Absolutely. I'm nearly 35 next month, and I want to feel good for as long as possible. And I think at the same time, I'm hearing a lot about longevity, and I've become really interested in it in a way that I never had considered before. And I think generally people are more, we are looking to live not just longer, but to live longer and feel as good as possible for as long as we can. What are your thoughts around longevity and this kind of movement?
I think your point there summarizes it. You know, longevity is not living more years, it's adding more years to your living. You know, and really we talk about health span, which is how long I can retain functionality deeper into my life. And you'll hear phrases like dying well, you know, which is, I don't want 20 years debilitated by a chronic neurological condition, or, you know, I don't want to not know who I am for 15 years. So what we're really looking at is, how do we delay lifestyle disease, and how do I extend my lifespan at the same time? So lifespan is how long I live. Health span is how many years I live well. And what we're understanding is this is something that really, a bit like sleep starts in the morning, longevity starts now. 35 is an interesting age, because, you know, somewhere around 35, the body goes, all right, Roxy, I gave you a fair crack at this. I gave you good fitness, good muscle retention, good hormonal balance. People might say, I didn't get any of those things, but you gave you the great chance. And then what we see is a diminishment of your core biology year on year.
Thank you so much for that.
It's been a joy to be with you. And it's somewhere.
Basically, congratulations, Roxy. It's all fucking downhill from here.
That's the birthday card. That is the birthday card. And it should be on every 35. And it's, some people it's 32, some people it's 42. Somewhere in this era, your body sort of, you know, goes, right, you know, I gave you
era, you just told me it was 35, which I'm turning in a month.
And I'd say, you know, look around professional sport. And if it's a broad, look at professional football. You won't see many peak professional footballers above the age of 35. For the reason, your biology starts to say, enough. I'm over-resourced, right? So what we have to distinguish is longevity is, how do I preserve biological capability as much as possible? So if I take you now at 35 and you at 65, you will have a significantly reduced ability to produce energy through your cardiovascular system, and less muscle mass to do all the basic tasks of your living, unless you tell them both that you need them still. So those are age-related loss in the absence of training load. So if I load up my cardiovascular exercise and, you know, do government guidelines, let's call it 150 minutes aggregated over a week, then I would expect to attenuate or even reverse that loss of cardiovascular fitness. Let's imagine I started weight training twice a week as per government guidelines, then I'd expect your muscle mass to be at least the same, maybe more, year on year. And you at 65 with the same cardiovascular capacity and the same muscle mass are a markedly different person. Not from a fitness point of view, from a day-to-day point of view, than the version of you that let them slip 30 years ago. And you know, youth isn't wasted on the young, but the opportunity of physiology is, you have this incredibly robust physiology. We're full of stem cells, estrogens, testosterones, you know, this wonderful collection of things that give us vitality and vivacity. Then your body goes, right, I gave you a chance to meet someone, mate, reproduce, pass on a bit of my gene. And now all those things are, I'm way over-resourced, and I'm just going to cannibalize them year on year, unless you don't. When we stretch out aging into what are all the things that age, and there was a journal in Cell called The Hallmarks of Aging, which is, why are we dying? And what you'll see in America is they're trying to turn aging into a disease and treat it as a disease. So if I know that these are things that change in the cells of my body from birth to death, why don't I just hack them? You know, if I can edit my genes, can I? If I can stop old cells creating cell damage, can I change that around? And we're seeing a very advanced form of what we call biogerontology, which is, you know, white coats, predominantly, you know, in America, but certainly around the world, trying to hack the aging process. And there's a biogerontologist out of Cambridge University who says he thinks there's a child born today who'll live to be 1,000 years old.
No.
Yeah. A professor, no less. So, we, you know, and that's on the idea that if we turn off the genes and the processes involved in aging, what does that look like? Now, that's fanciful, but what we are seeing is we are understanding the biology of aging, and we're seeing which things influence it. A lot of people might have been drawn to a guy, Brian Johnson, who's sort of the modern father of longevity, because he's trying everything that may enhance or delay one of these biological processes of aging. And I think before we get to Brian Johnson, who takes 155 supplements a day and four off-license medications and all these other things, and I think is a net positive figure in the world of lifestyle, the big four things he would do for longevity is preserve cardiovascular fitness as measured through a metric called VO2 max, preserve muscle mass and strength through rigorous daily weight training. He makes sleep his superhero because all of my biological restoration takes place in those sleep stages, particularly the health of my brain. And he calorie restricts using fasting methodologies. So at the heart of the most advanced, you know, program of anti-aging in the world are four things we can all do, which is manage down the total volume of calories we eat, fastidiously focus on quality sleep and those particularly deep sleep and REM sleep, make sure we cardiovascularly train and resistance train. Now that's before we get to purpose and social connection and the work of Dan Buettner and Blue Zones and where are people living longer when they're tribal and they all love each other and you know and we all eat whole grains, et cetera. But at the core of longevity is how do I preserve the biological systems that I took for granted and now no longer can afford to? And the earlier you start, the bigger the reward will be.
You've just summarized that so beautifully and so well. And I think it feels it makes me feel good and it makes me feel excited and it makes me feel more positive about the future and about aging and about turning 35 and all those things, because I think that we, with the kind of development of science, aren't we lucky that we get to figure out all these amazing things that we can do? I mean, I went for, do you know that Necco place? I went and had my test done and everything was pretty good, except my grip strength was really poor. And for me, that was a real indicator, okay, I need to be doing more exercise. I need to be doing more weight training. You know, I think I'm very fortunate. I have a body type that probably appears more muscular than it actually is. But in a way, it's done me a disservice because I think, oh, well, I look like I've got muscle, so I must be quite strong. So I don't need to exercise as much. But actually, going and having these tests have really shown me, no, it's not just about how it looks. You haven't got the muscular strength that you need to live well for longer.
And that's spot on. And lots of people end up buying. So grip strength is a very good predictor of mortality, you know, length of life fundamentally. Grip is sort of an indicator of total body strength, which is an indicator of total muscle mass. So it's a test before a test before a test. And the reality is if you don't have enough muscle, it's a real challenge to be well. And we've sort of got to retake the gyms from people who've got extra muscle. You know, when I go to the gym and people are like, oh, Ollie, you don't look like you go to the gym.
Wow, rude.
Yeah, I've got great friends. Remember, I was introduced once, I did a well-being talk, and the guy goes, what I love about Ollie, he doesn't look like a wellness professional. if he's out there listening, you know who you are. And I was like, that's a lovely comment. I really, really appreciate that. And, you know, but my job is not to build muscle. My job is to stop the loss of muscle. You know, I train the minimum amount possible to keep my VO2 max. I train the minimum amount. So I do a body composition quarterly and I've got a skeletal muscle mass volume at 44 kilograms of muscle mass. My job is just to make sure that never goes less than 44.
What is the minimum you have to do to
so
keep that?
About 1.5 weight training sessions a week. So three over a 2 week period. So I might feast a bit, famine a bit, you know, but if that goes down, so this is where data becomes hyper-personalized. So if I go down, I need to do more weight training. If it goes up, I can be a little easier on myself. We've got the metric VO2 max, which is the objective measurement of cardiorespiratory fitness. That's been embedded into wearables. So most people's wearables will measure VO2 max. That will tell me whether I do enough cardiovascular exercise. Data allows me to determine the dosage, you know, because I don't want to look at government guidelines to work out what I need.
Yeah.
So where I use a wearable is to titrate the dose to the minimum dose possible that I can get away with keeping those biological systems while dicking about with my kids and you know, being involved in all the things I love.
I did check to see if you were wearing a wearable. I was surprised that you weren't.
That's the new
hidden
one. So this is so I've got all of them.
Okay.
And wear them all. So we have released what's called an MG. So this is a medical grade.
Is that what this is?
So this now adds to the parameters previously, but it was continuous blood pressure and the ability to run an ECG electrocardiogram.
Wow.
So they're trying to move now into collecting more clinical wearables.
For anyone that can't see, that is on audio only.
Yeah.
I thought he didn't have a wearable because it was not on his fingers. So you don't look for people's wedding rings anymore.
No.
You look for their wearable.
I don't. And I tell you what, if I had more masculine hands, I probably would wear the ring. But it draws attention to that. The ring
But you pulled up your sleeve and you're wearing it on your wrist.
Yeah, so that's Whoop. So your big players in the market, Aura, Whoop, Garmin, these are all collecting similar variables. Mm-hmm. Heart rate variability, which is that look of the nervous system around stress and recovery, sleep cycling and sleep staging, general markers of physical activity. And what they're all trying to do is ask you how you feel and what you're doing and then match that to the data. Mm-hmm. So what we'll get to is technology sort of 3.0. You'll go, look, I feel a bit tired today. What should I do? Mm-hmm. And based on your previous patterns of behavior and your previous data, you'll go, oh, today, have your last coffee at 11 and go and see your friend Jane, mm-hmm. because it knows those two things historically drive more recovery. So we're nearing the point where the devices can tell us what to do based on previous patterns of behavior.
Interesting. If you could give people one biohack that actually works, what would it be? You can do more than one, actually.
The challenge would be, you've got to find the one thing you're worst at.
Yeah.
I think you've got to look at your life across, you know, and score your behaviors across cardio, you know, let's not even be that specific, across your quality of movement, do you move, quality of nutrition, quality of sleep, quality of stress management, quality of self-talk, and your physical, social, cultural environment. Let's imagine we've got those six categories. And I would score them all out of 10 in terms of how good you are compared to what are the general guidelines. And the one you score lowest in is the one you should lean into.
I love that. That is such easy, good advice.
You'll know there is no thing that's going to save us all, apart from consistent wake time. But I think, you know, principally, if your sleep is great, a sleep tip isn't going to get you there. Mm-hmm. And we just got to play that slightly more holistic, you know, lens to ourselves. Mm. And the piece across that, which you promote beautifully, is that self-compassion, you know, that kindness to self, because you have to believe you're worthy of this, you know, and truthfully, this is not the path of least resistance now. You know, the path of least resistance for the average person is to gain weight, to feel anxious, to not sleep well, to be socially disconnected, to be, you know, consumed by toxicity. So you're going to have to prioritize these things, and to prioritize them, that will come at a cost, and you have to be worth that cost. Mm-hmm. So the first piece of a true well-being strategy is feeling you deserve it, and then start with your area for greatest improvement rather than greatest weakness, and dive in there, I think.
Oh, so beautiful. I think that's such a perfect way to end that I'm just going to ask you with one last question, which is, what does rising mean to you?
Rising is growth for me, which is the fact that actually the volume of stresses I can cope with today will be less, you know, will be less impactful tomorrow. So I'm always searching for that little bit more than I can handle. That is the path to growth. If I want to grow my muscles, I give it something it can't quite handle. If I want to grow emotionally, I take on situations I can't quite handle. Mm. Rising is the fact that we never get there, but we should be growing by just that, doing that thing that's a little bit out of our comfort zone on a regular basis, on the basis, Roxy, that we give ourselves the recovery to enable that growth.
Yeah.
So growth through doing things that are just slightly more than we can currently do, offset against self-compassion, kindness, and recovery, that would be rising for me.
Oh, Ollie, thank you so much. I'm going to have to get you back because I feel like I could just talk to you for hours. You are so knowledgeable and you break things down so easily. And I feel like I've learned so much, and I know everyone listening and watching will have as well. So thank you so much.
It's an absolute privilege. Thank you for having me.
I absolutely loved that conversation with Ollie. I found that his advice was so actionable, so easy to implement, and really made me look at health and wellness in this really holistic approach. I think there was something in there for everyone, and I really hope that you guys took a lot from it too. If you did, please do rate, share, or follow the episode. It really does help. And don't forget that we're now doing bonus episodes where I'm answering all your dilemmas and giving you my best advice. So if you want something answered, just send me a DM on the Rise with Roxy Instagram, or you can send an email to risewithroxy@bowelmedia.co.uk. Until next time, keep rising up, rising above, and rising again.
A Rayo Original Podcast.